Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 16th of July 2014, and I am delighted to welcome to the programme this week the independent filmmaker David Malone, who in a career spanning nearly 20 years has variously produced, directed, written and presented documentaries both for the BBC and Channel 4. His Testing God series was shortlisted for the Royal Television Society Best Documentary Series, and in 2008 his production for the BBC High Anxieties, The Mathematics of Chaos, was among the first documentaries to be made about the current financial crisis. He's also author of the highly regarded book The Debt Generation, published in 2010, which critiqued the scandalous bailing out of the banks and the effete political system that allowed that to take place. David, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Mind Renewed.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, we're going to be talking today about international trade deals, which I think can sound extremely dull indeed. But as you made clear in that presentation that you gave in Manchester a few weeks ago, this is actually a very, very important subject to us all. And we're going to be looking at things like the TPP, TTIP, or TAFTA, as it's also known, and TISA, and things like BITS and ISDSs and all this sort of acronym soup that members of the superclass might be hoping that we'll perhaps find too unpalatable to swallow, that we'll just, you know, pass by without too much question.
I think that's their general idea, yes.
Yes. Now, I'm going to ask you in a minute to sort of remind us about what these things are, but just let me say that the TPP, of course, is that very secretive proposed agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the TTIP is also another secretive proposed Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, otherwise known as the Transatlantic Free Trade Area between the EU and the US. And I'm going to leave all the rest of the decoding of acronyms to you for later on, if I may. As I say, we'll go into those particular things in a moment. Could I start by asking you to tell us something about your background? How is it that you, as a documentary filmmaker for the BBC and Channel 4, how did you get so concerned about this subject?
Well, I worked for the BBC Science Department. So what I was supposed to be doing was reporting on science and making science documentaries. And I always have. But I suppose starting in about 1995, I started to get very concerned about something which nobody has heard of, or very few, something called GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. And that was the thing which eventually morphed into and created the World Trade Organization. It was the sort of the first global organization which said, we have now have the authority to enforce trade agreements upon nations and peoples. And what bothered me about it is when we signed what was called the Uruguay Round of GATT, nobody heard about it. And it was not reported anywhere. And in fact, as far as I remember, it was passed in Parliament virtually on the nod. There was almost no discussion. And yet, if you look at it, that agreement signed away huge chunks of our sovereignty. And what bothered me most was that the very people who then and since have bleated on and on about how terrible the EU is and how it's a threat to our sovereignty and we must regain the sovereignty back to Great Britain, they were the same people who enthusiastically signed away far more of our sovereignty when they signed up to the GATT. So basically, I, from that moment on, began to be very concerned about what I saw as a growing opposition between the aims of those who advocated global free market ideology and democracy, and, you know, the control of our destiny by us. And I asked if I could make a film at the time, and they said no. I made one anyway. I just disguised it as a science program. And from that point onwards, I started to get very interested, but it was something that bubbled away. But then when the crisis started, I, like everybody else, I was just incensed. And all I did then really was I decided that I would go and listen in on the conversations that traders, day traders, were having with each other. And there are various online sites where day traders talk to each other. Most of it is in trader gibberish, where they're talking about, you know, if you buy a forward contract at 125 with a stop out at 75, and
it's okay. It doesn't mean anything to me.
No, it doesn't mean anything to anybody else. Yeah. But what was interesting, Julian, is that in between this fast and furious conversation about who should buy what at what price, what emerged was their commentary, their analysis of what was going on day to day in the markets. And what I quickly saw was that what they were saying was going on was diverging rapidly at warp speed from the story we were being told on the television. Now, somebody had to be wrong. But what I realized was that they were sitting at their computer and betting their family's house, their own money, on their analysis. So they had to be right. And I found that what they were saying was sometimes quite at odds with their own quite self-evident ideology. These were generally Americans of the, you know, red, white, and blue, my country right or wrong, bomb them back to the Stone Age variety. So I didn't have anything in common with them. But sometimes what they said, I was surprised. I thought, gosh, that's a strong thing for someone like that to say. And what I realized is they had to be honest with themselves. They couldn't pretend to themselves for some ideological reason, because they were going to take their money and bet it on their analysis the next day. And so, and over, as the months went by and I continued to read, most of what they said turned out to be true. Most of what I heard on the news was utter tosh. And not only did that alarm me, but it made me angry, because I realized that we were being fed a story for some motive which wasn't clear at the time, but it wasn't, we weren't being told the truth. And so from there, I just started writing hundreds of thousands of words of outrage and read as much as I could find. And from there, the blog and the book emerged. I've just been self-educated. And I always say that I have no letters after my name to do with economics. I don't have an economics degree. I'm not from any think tank. I'm just a bloke who reads widely and tries to think clearly about what he's read. And I never cease to be appalled at how far away from the self-evident reality of what's going on in the markets is the story that we're told. We're just told something which doesn't match up. It's just not true. You know, they spent years telling us this was a liquidity crisis. The banks were fine. They just couldn't find the tenor in the bottom of their pocket. And everybody in the markets knew. I talked to bankers, because after a while I became well known and lots of people in finance would send me emails or talk to me, and they were very clear. No, this is not. We're not just short of a tenor. It's not a liquidity crisis. We're broke. This is a solvency crisis. But you never heard that from the pundits or the politicians. And it's one thing to be robbed, which we were. It's another thing to be lied to and condescended to by the same person who's got their hand in your pocket.
Absolutely, indeed. Well, I don't think anybody who's listening to this podcast will be at all surprised by what you've said there, because I think we're being lied to in many different ways, indeed. And the documentary that you were talking about that you managed to slip through, was that the High Anxieties one, The Mathematics of Chaos?
No. The High Anxieties was the follow-up 10 years later or so. Ah. The first one I made was called Icon Earth, and it was, as far as I'm aware, it was the first ever film which looked critically at this whole idea of a globalized economy and global free trade and globalization. It was 1996, and I smuggled it through the science department by calling it Icon Earth, saying that I was going to look at that picture of the blue planet as a modern icon, a picture which concentrated a highly symbolic message. And in that, I talked about globalization and looked at, you know, the free flow of money, the free flow of people, the free flow of goods, that mantra of globalization. And then I had to defend my job after that film, because various economists were furious and tried to have me fired.
God, I say.
Yeah, well, that was quite serious. Yes, it was economics think tank person wrote to the director general and said, this man needs to be fired.
Was this partly because you had revealed what your intention was beforehand, so it was known what you were trying to do through the film?
No. It was after it was transmitted, and they were livid and furious and said it. And the letter of complaint said it was a dangerous piece of anti-capitalist propaganda. So I was so pleased with it, I framed that.
Right.
I still have it.
Yes. Yeah.
And then the High Anxieties, they never let me make a follow-up film to Icon Earth. I was told that, you know, they would never commission another film like that from me ever. But the same thing happened. I made a film, convinced them to make a film about, you know, the mathematics of non-linearity. But in that film, I just pointed out that mathematics had told us a century ago that some systems are non-linear, and what that meant. And we knew that the economy and the environment were those systems. And yet, for a century, we've turned a blind eye to what we knew mathematically would be the case. And, you know, 2008, it was the case.
Yeah.
So all those people who said, oh, who could have known? Well, actually, mathematicians since 1889 knew, actually.
And indeed, that was often said. I remember Peter Schiff saying things like that and saying, well, nobody was predicting this was going to happen. He was saying, yeah, but I was.
Yeah,
and a number of other people were, of course, indeed. And of course, there are voices now saying that there's going to be yet a continuation of this. But the mainstream media continues with this lie that things are going to just get better and better.
Well, the mainstream media is embedded. I mean, that phrase was an interesting one that came out of the wars in Iraq, wasn't it? That to get anywhere to be allowed to report, you had to be embedded with the army.
Yes.
And that meant that you had to virtually agree to say certain things and not say others. Well, the financial journalists have been embedded like ticks for years. I mean, if you say something rude about Goldman Sachs as a financial journalist, do you really think they'll invite you to the next time that they reveal? I mean, it's not going to happen, is it? And so they toe the line.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a sort of self-selecting, isn't it? It's the kind of people who say the right sort of things who continue along the career path, and they remain there.
Well, they Stephanie Flanders, you know, she's there to give us an even and balanced view of the financial crisis, and then we find that she moves to, was it J.P. Morgan?
Yes, I think you're right.
Okay, well, that was obviously fair and balanced, and she had no ideological position.
That's a pure coincidence, David, that one.
A pure coincidence, of course. Yeah.
Well, you can speak your mind freely on this podcast, so I'm going to ask you now if you wouldn't mind to give us a kind of brief recap on what the TPP and TTIP are, because as I said before, people will be familiar with it, but perhaps a bit rusty about these. So could you tell us something about their history and how those came into being?
Yeah. On the surface, they're trade agreements, just agreements between two nations or a bunch of nations about how they're going to conduct trade. So it doesn't sound like anything new. But they are built like Russian dolls. So on the outside is the thing you're familiar with. It's only when you open the first doll and look inside, you think, oh, gosh, I didn't know that was in there. And then if you're really persistent and you open that one, you find things inside, you think, crikey, you've got to be kidding me. Essentially, trade agreements have been going on for centuries. And the problem with trade agreements is they're essentially diplomatic agreements between heads of state. And so they're large and unwieldy, and as history tells us, it's easy to sign up to something and then just sort of ignore it. I mean, what are they going to do? Send the Navy? And this is the problem with trade agreements. This was the problem that the World Trade Organization had, that it was a great fanfare, a world headquarters, and, you know, this was going to be a framework that would bind every nation. But every nation found ways of holding up compliance for years and years and years. And industry got very restive. They sort of lost faith in the whole World Trade Organization business. And they wanted some other way that was quicker, faster, and in which they had more of a say. Because again, trade agreements are agreements between two nations. The breakthrough came with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And NAFTA is very different. It is a trade agreement. It's the first of the modern trade agreements. But what they did is they built inside it a thing called a bilateral investment treaty. And that gives teeth which were never there before. So then all the things that you would like your trade agreement to do, you can now enforce because you've got this other mechanism inside. I mean, anyone who's ever read about NAFTA or heard about it, generally when NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was Canada, US, and Mexico, whenever it's in the news, it's generally, you hear the phrase, Chapter 11. Chapter 11 of NAFTA. Chapter 11 is what's called a bilateral investment treaty, and it is the thing inside the TTIP and the European agreement and all modern agreements, because it's what gives them teeth. The trade agreement between America and the European Union, there's lots of things in that which the industry on both sides of the Atlantic is very keen on. You know, the Americans would like to harmonize. That's a lovely phrase. It's like efficiency.
Yeah, so it sounds wonderful indeed. Yeah.
Yes. We're going to make everything more efficient. So now we're going to harmonize. And so they'll be quick to tell you that doesn't mean that we're lowering standards. We're just harmonizing them. Right. Okay. So we're not going to gas you. You're just going to have a shower.
Well, are they right? Are they going to lower standards, though?
Yeah, of course they have lower standards. the European Union has always annoyed the heck out of American industry. We're talking here, one of the main lobby groups in America, and the American government has made it very clear, they want access to the European markets, which are huge, for their agricultural products. And what's bedeviled them here is we have the we operate on the principle, the precautionary principle. In other words, if you want to sell food here or produce food in a certain way, you have to prove that it's safe. In America, that's not the case. It's assumed to be safe, and the government has to prove harm. So, for instance, there was a case between Canada and an American company, and it was to do with an additive in petrol. This is from some years ago, an additive called MMT, and the Canadians banned it because they looked at the data and they said, this is nasty stuff, we don't want it. The American company said, you haven't been using the right data and you can't prove this. And so they just took this opposite view. The American industry said, well, you know, you haven't got the right proof, and the assumption is it's safe. That's how it does work on that side of the Atlantic. They want to harmonize through this trade agreement. And what that essentially means is, let's get rid of the precautionary principle and harmonize it to our way of doing things, which would mean, for instance, having growth hormones in beef. Now, the professions involved here feel very dubious about these growth hormones, and so we don't allow them. The Americans will say, you haven't proved that they're harmful, so we should harmonize them and they should be allowed. And the same with their ways of producing chickens. The animal welfare there is diabolical, but at the end of it, you just douse your chicken in chlorine.
Yeah, and this is going to be the same with GMOs, presumably, because we operate on that precautionary principle here, don't we, at the moment with that?
Right, and they have said many times, and there was a recent one where they said, in almost as many words, don't start casting doubt on the safety or the efficacy or anything else of GMOs. But more than that, they would like to get rid of country of origin labeling and whether something contains GMOs. We have that, which in my view, you would say, well, that's just consumer choice. Oh, no, in this particular case, the free market says, no, there shouldn't be any. You shouldn't get to know. And in case there's anyone out there with a, you know, thinking, well, hang on a second, you know, yeah, of course we should have to prove it, you know, that there's a danger. That was the argument used by the tobacco companies. The fact that people who smoke got cancer, the line they took, and which will be the line they'll take over anything else, is, can you prove that that person's cancer came from that cigarette? Well, obviously you can't. Well, therefore, you don't have the proof.
No. So you could have a situation with GMOs where it could be generations before such links are established and all that damage would be done.
And even after the damage is self-evidently happening, they'll say, but can you prove it was this?
Yes.
And that's how the tobacco companies held up what was glaringly obvious for two generations, maybe? Mm. Is that the route we want to go down? Well, it is the route that our leaders want us to go down because they're ready to sign.
And do you have concerns also about wages and the environment and working standards and all these sorts of things with these agreements as well?
Yes. I mean, in order to answer that, you have to look at these things, which I said are nested inside the trade agreements. I mean, so far we've talked about that outside doll, what they will do. And I think that's worrying enough. But of course, if it was just the doll on the outside, they wouldn't be able to enforce it because, you know, let's say another government of a different stripe gets elected in the next election here and they say, yeah, well, I know we signed up to that, but, you know, we're a sovereign nation, so we're just not going to enforce that. Well, what would anyone do? Answer, nothing. They'd huff and they'd puff, and short of sending in the Marines, there's nothing they could do about it. So that's where the bilateral investment treaty, the doll that's nested inside, comes in, because what that does is give you a means of enforcing. And it's not left to your nation state. America doesn't have to take Britain to court. A company, a foreign company, can take a sovereign nation to arbitration. That's what the bilateral investment treaty says. It has sort of four sort of things that are inside it, that it's got to be no nationalization or expropriation, equal treatment to local companies, fair and equitable, whatever that means, and you have to accept arbitration of disputes. I'll come to arbitration is in a minute. But the no nationalization or expropriation, on the surface, that sounds fine. It sounds like, you know, if you as a foreign company build a battery factory in the Congo and then there's a revolution and they take your factory, well, it does sound reasonable to say, well, they should get some kind of compensation, shouldn't they? Surely there's some way they can get some comeback. And it's those examples that the advocates of the bilateral investment treaties always trot out. But the problem is this word expropriation. Put a word like that in the hands of international lawyers and something interesting happens. Expropriation to you and me says they came and they took your factory. They took your house off you. Now what it means is any action taken by a government which would reduce the expected profits. So that could mean you brought in a slightly more stringent regulation for that particular product, or it could be that you said, well, the packaging has to be recyclable now. Any action like that, or, you know, to say that the level of the water being pumped out the back of a factory has to be a little bit cleaner, that will eat into their profits. That's now expropriation.
So even on a minimal level, just as a slight change to their profits.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, companies have taken nations to arbitration where they've had less than $1 million in actual investment and been awarded hundreds of millions. They just have to say, we expected to make this kind of profit, and now you've changed your mind, and that eats into our profit. So to give you a concrete example, once foreign companies, and you see it's foreign companies, only a foreign company has access to the bilateral investment treaty. A UK company can't. Of course, there are ways around that, and I'll tell you about those in a minute. So let's take the example of fracking. Once a foreign company like Elf or Total are allowed to take up those contracts and start, they will then be able to get their economists to say, right, we've been given the rights to frack in these three areas, let's say, and we expect we will make, let's say, 400 million. And then we have a change of government, and the government says, actually, you know what? We don't like fracking. We've looked at the data. We think this is dodgy. We're going to stop it. Well, you won't be able to stop it, because they would be able to take the nation to arbitration and say, you expropriated from us our reasonable expectation of profits in the future. We have lost future profits, not even profits they've made yet, just future ones. And they will win. How can I say they'll win? Because those kind of cases have been already arbitrated and the companies have won. Quebec tried to ban fracking. They were taken to court by, I think, a company called Lone Pine. I can't remember now. And they lost.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible. So the only way in which a nation would be able to stop a company like that doing something would be basically by bankrupting the nation, essentially, to pay off all these suing demands.
Yes. I mean, Ecuador was taken to arbitration by Occidental. Occidental were awarded $1.7 billion. Do you reckon Ecuador has a back room where they've got $1.7 billion lying around? I don't think so.
Indeed.
But that's just expropriation. And the fantastic thing is, if you read what the lawyers, because there's a small group of lawyers who are involved with arbitration, another one of the things they're toying with now, and I've seen it written, is that tax rises above what is considered to be a reasonable internationally recognized level of taxation could be considered expropriation. But who is it who decides what's a reasonable expectation?
Them, presumably.
Exactly. Give that man a crackerjack pencil. Exactly. They decide. So they would be able to take a nation to arbitration on the basis that that nation should no longer be allowed to set its own tax laws. Now, if that isn't a loss of sovereignty, I do not know what is. And that's not me saying it. Just go to the technical literature of the arbitrators, and there it is in black and white in their publications, not mine. So that's just the first one. Mm. Equal treatment. You think, well, that sounds fine.
Well, can I just stop you there for a moment? I will come on to that.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I wanted to ask you about what this investor state dispute settlement mechanism is, because that's embedded within this BIT that you've just been talking about.
That's the doll inside. That's that fourth part of the bilateral investment treaty, the accept arbitration.
Uh-huh.
What that is a company can serve notice on a nation that's in dispute with, saying, we're taking you to arbitration. Now, arbitration is not a court. It is not part of any international series of courts. There's no judge, there's no jury. It's not part of the UN or anybody else, and Superman doesn't get a look in. Arbitration works as follows. Three arbitrators will be chosen. One by the company that's taking the nation to arbitration, second one by the nation to defend it, and the third one will be agreed upon by the first two arbitrators. If they can't agree, there's a mechanism for someone just choosing the third arbitrator for you. Those three people, and they are just people, they are private individuals, almost exclusively drawn from the top 15 global law firms, companies like Freshfields, which are vast, they are a small group of international lawyers drawn from those companies. Those three people, mostly men, mostly European or American, meet behind closed doors. They don't have to publish what evidence was adduced, who gave that evidence, what they said, and they don't have to justify their decision. They don't have to give you a written statement of why they decided in favor of the company or in favor of the nation. And there is no appeals process. And you, as a member of a nation, have, and this I'm quoting from someone, you have no rights within that process. That's a quote from a law professor who's an expert on arbitration. No rights.
So you have no right to know what's going on in that at all?
No. And in fact, in some of those arbitrations, there's a small handful of private limited companies which run, which oversee the arbitration process. So it doesn't happen in a court. It doesn't happen in The Hague or the UN. There's a small number of things like the London Court of International Arbitration, but that's actually a private limited company, or the International Chamber of Commerce, which is actually a business lobby group. They oversee the process. So private limited companies, nothing to do with the state or super or the UN or anybody else, private limited organizations or business lobby groups oversee the arbitration process. The arbitrators are chosen from a short list of about 15 to 25 of the largest global law firms. And who do you think those law firms get most of their income from? Do you reckon they do pro bono work for Greenpeace or, you know, lobby on behalf of trade unions? No, most of their work comes from the global corporations, so they're not going to bite the hands that feeds them.
So is it right then that ministers of the state get no access to any of this information either?
God couldn't get access. There is none, because they're private limited companies. They don't have to. And in fact, the one in London, which is the most secretive, they don't even publish when a nation has gone to arbitration. So let's say a big company would taken the UK to arbitration and done it through the London court, we wouldn't know. They could be in arbitration now and we wouldn't know. And we wouldn't know who said what. We wouldn't know what the evidence was. We would have no access to the judgment, no appeal. We would just get served with a bill, which would be paid because it can be enforced.
But presumably the government would know that this was taking place. So do they actually have to go to arbitration? Is there not another way of sorting it out first without going through that process?
There's a cooling off period beforehand. But if you've signed up to a bilateral investment treaty, and this country has signed 80 or more, I think, was the last figure, which just means agreement between any two countries. And obviously, if we signed up to the TPP, that would be between us and Europe and America. So once you've signed them, you have signed up to those four principles that I mentioned, including the going to arbitration. And countries have tried to thumb their nose at it and gone to arbitration and lost and said, well, we're not, so what? We're not paying. And whenever I give a talk, somebody always says, but why don't we just, you know, tell them to go and take a long walk off a short plank? And the problem is there are within international finance ways of them taking your money the way a bailiff can come and take your car. They can do it.
May I ask you how they can do that?
Yes, and I can give you the example. This happened to Argentina. Argentina has had various bits of its national wealth taken. And the way it happens is this. All nations have parts of their national wealth abroad. Like most nations have all of their gold stored in London. The second, perhaps more important part is because of the way that the modern monetary system works, virtually all nations, barring a handful, raise money by selling debt. You know, the Americans will sell T-bills and we sell what's called gilts. And those gilts have to be repaid. And if you don't repay them, that's called a default. And then, you know, the free marketeers will tell you the sky will fall in. It won't necessarily, but that's a whole other story.
That's the fear that controls the system, yeah.
Precisely. But never mind, let's assume that they're right for the sake of argument. And so what happens is, let's say your company, Julian Inc., took Great Britain to arbitration and you won, all right, because we'd expropriated something from you. And then Great Britain tried to thumb its nose at you. What you would do is you would go to the Southern District Court of Manhattan, which is Wall Street's court. And this is where the action happens. And what you would do is you wouldn't sue Great Britain directly. What you would do is you would sue the banks who handle the settlements of our debt. When we have to pay off our debts, we don't do it direct. You know, George Osborne isn't in there writing checks. several of what's called the largest custodial banks, which are almost all Americans, Citicorp, Mellon, JP Morgan Chase, those banks settle our debts for it. So what they do is they go to the Southern District and they sue them. It's a legal phrase called pari passu, which means to treat equally. And it says the bank must treat all its clients equally. So the bank does work for Great Britain. The bank is saying, right, Great Britain owes its bondholders. It's got to pay up on some of its bonds. So we're Great Britain's bank. We'll do that work on behalf of Great Britain and pay those clients. But you turn up and you say, but Great Britain owes me money. And you're not helping me get my money out of Great Britain. So you're treating me and your other customers differently. You, Mr. Bank, are breaking the law. If you continue to favor one set of people that Great Britain owes money to over me, you allow Great Britain to settle up with them, but you don't allow Great Britain to settle up with me,
right,
then you are breaking the law, and I am going to sue you, the bank, for billions. And the banks back down. And the banks then get on the phone to Great Britain and say, look, I'm really sorry, mate. I'd love to help you, but I'm being sued by this fellow who's very angry that I'm not helping him. So I can't any longer help you settle, pay off your debts, your international debt, which means you're going to default.
So effectively, I could hold the whole system to ransom in that way. Perhaps just a few who have debts that need to be settled could do that.
That's exactly what vulture funds do. That is how vulture funds work. So the same bit of law, we know that it works because the vulture funds use it all the time, and they have just used it successfully against Argentina. That is the threat lying at the center of the investor-state dispute settlement. And it's why it works, because they can seize your goods and they can cause you to default on all, in our case, hundreds of billions in debt, which would then frighten the life out of George Osborne, so he will back down. So when they're taken to arbitration and they lose, they say, gosh, okay, so we've got to pay a couple of billion. Well, okay, it's better than defaulting on our entire sovereign debt. So they pay up. And we know it works. You see, it's not me telling you in theory this is how it works. I'm telling you this is how it has worked, past tense.
So there's just no way they can walk away from this. They have to just accept what they've signed up to, and whatever the consequences are, they have to accept it.
Yes, and they know full well from looking at how these things have been used in the past what will happen. So then it's not like they're signing up to something and then in 6 weeks' time George Osborne goes, oh, really? Gosh, sorry, I didn't know. Really shouldn't have signed that. They know. So they're signing you up so that that will be the case. It sounds ridiculous, I know. And there's a strong temptation to say, this fellow on the end of the phone is just a lunatic. And I sincerely wish I was. I sincerely wish someone could say, look, you've just forgotten this. But I haven't. It is the case.
And there are some other principles in there that you mentioned that I actually interrupted you on, the equal treatment and fair and equitable treatment. What on earth do those phrases mean?
Well, equal treatment sounds great, and on the surface it is great. It just says, look, you can't treat one of your national companies better than you treat a foreign company. Mm-hmm. You've got to have an even playing field. Sounds reasonable until you think that that's the basis of how the NHS works. We say we will give this work to the NHS because we would like to have a thing called the NHS. And under a bilateral investment treaty, the NHS is illegal because it gives unfair, they get the work without having to bid for it against the company. We just say, no, that's the NHS. The BBC would be another one. That's completely unfair because it gets government support, like the NHS gets government support. They would say, you can't give taxes to the NHS, so it would be illegal. So part of the process that's gone on in trying to come up with a text which can be signed is to make a derogation, as they call it. Just say, okay, well, this is the principle, but we're going to exempt the NHS or we'll exempt the BBC, which makes you think, oh, phew, that's okay. Yeah, but the problem is the thin end of the wedge is already in. You've accepted the general principle.
Sure.
At some point, it'd be very, very simple for someone to say, well, we've signed this thing. We just now think that we will include parts of the NHS and then a little bit more of the NHS and then all of the NHS. It would be easy to do because the wedge is already in. And there's no reason to think that that wouldn't happen because certain political parties have been keen to get rid of the NHS for ages. This would be a really good way of doing it because they'd, at every step of the way, they'd be able to say, look, it's not us. It's just, no, we signed up to this. It's the law. And fair and equitable, the problem with it is, what does it actually mean? And some of the cases that have been settled under fair and equitable are just absolutely ridiculous. it means that what's fair and what's equitable and what's equal treatment are handed to a small group of private individuals who work for large law firms who decide in secret what those things mean. Well, I don't know. Do you think they'll decide on behalf of us or more likely on the side of large business? I don't know.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you to what extent you think these arbitrators are going to be keen on things like social justice and environmental pollution and labor laws and all these sorts of things.
Well, they've made it very clear. I mean, it's already in writing. Several of them have made it very clear that they feel those things have no place in arbitration, because arbitration, they will say, simply looks at whether the contract that was signed has been honored or in some way infringed upon. Therefore, environmental matters, there's no sort of environmental principle in their world. You can't say, oh, it's okay, we broke that contract, but we did it in a principled way. Well, principle schminciple. Did you break the contract or didn't you? And if you did break the contract, you go to arbitration and you lose. I mean, when Germany, after Fukushima, Germany said we're going to close the nuclear reactors. Why? Well, there was a vast public move in favor of it. Now, as far as I'm concerned, a vast public move in favor of something is called democracy. At least it is in my world. It is in Scarborough. That's how
right,
we look at it.
Right, yes.
We're a funny old place, Scarborough. The company, the Swedish company that ran those nuclear reactors, Vattenfall, has taken Germany to arbitration, and they're suing them for $700 million because they say you have expropriated our future profits. There was another case where a company was horribly polluting. I can't remember. I think it might have been El Salvador. The El Salvadoran government, after a great deal of lobbying by the peoples that lived there, finally said, okay, we're going to refuse your permit for a waste disposal site because we do feel, we agree with the people, this will massively pollute the waterways. They were taken to arbitration, and I think the company was awarded $300-odd million.
Presumably that was based on the idea that the government in question had just not assessed the situation properly in the first place.
Yeah, but I mean, here's one. It's a company called Doe Run, which is part of the Renco Group. It's a big group, and they took Peru to arbitration. What happened is the company took over a lead smelting plant in a place called La Oroya, which is, if you put into Google, world's most polluted places. I think it's like number 8. I mean, if you think of all the polluted places in the world, to be in the top 10, okay, you wouldn't want to have a picnic there. Mm-hmm. And they took over this lead smelting plant. Now, the company, when they took it over, when they signed the contract, said, as part of the agreement with Peru, we will do various kinds of cleanup. Right? They failed. They didn't do those things. And they, when confronted with this fact, they said, oh, well, economic difficulties, we couldn't. And then the company went bankrupt. And Peru said, well, okay, then you can't do lead smelting there. And you'd think that Peru would take Doe Run to arbitration or to court for failing to do things. Yeah. Actually, it was the other way around. Doe Run took Peru to arbitration and sued them for $800 million.
And succeeded.
I can't remember whether they succeeded or not. But if you just to go to arbitration costs $8 million. You know, Peru's not the kind of place that can throw around 8 million, never mind 800 million. But the point is, the arbitrators are, you know, they're happy with that.
That's extraordinary. They should actually try and sue on that basis, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, because the arbitrators will say, well, we don't take cases that are flagrantly ridiculous. Okay, but you took that one. If that's not flagrantly ridiculous, could you please define for me what you regard as flagrantly ridiculous? I mean, that's at the far end of flagrant and ridiculous in my world.
Yes,
maybe
indeed.
I've led a sheltered life, but
that's a very, very worrying precedent there. So we could see those flaring up all over the place, and just basically such companies fleecing nation states left, right, and centre.
And they do. They have. This is the thing about this. It's not hypothetical. I could bore you for hours just reading you one case after another.
Yeah.
And it's cases we don't know about.
Absolutely. And it's not just the money that's in view here, is it? It's also the power is the big question really here, because presumably it's going to stop nation states from making all sorts of decisions that they would otherwise make.
You're exactly right. The main effect of this is it has what's called, what you'll see referred to as a chilling effect on legislation. The nations will look at something and go, actually we can't do that. So when the Labour Party says, well, we'll put a big tax on something or other, actually they won't, because that would be expropriating future earnings and they'll be taken to arbitration.
that they say they're going to do it, yet they know that they can't.
Well, in the terms of the Labour Party, I'm not sure he does know. I mean, this is the astonishing thing that I mean, I've seen internal Labour Party briefing documents, and Humpty Dumpty could have written something clearer. I mean, they're just utterly confused. It's very clear they don't know what's going on from their internal documents. I mean, it is quite an obscure part of international law. It's not been on the front pages. And the fact that it's not been on the front pages raises many questions in my mind. So I think I know for a fact that many members of parliament don't know, because I've talked to them and they don't know. Whether the leaders of parties don't know, I suspect the leadership of the Labour Party is not clear. The Liberal Democrats, they don't need to be clear because that's not their job. They're just fluffers. So, you know, they've got their job and they're doing it.
Careful now. You don't know who's listening.
Well, I'm hoping they are. But I think people, it's not just the public that don't know. Because these things aren't signed by David Cameron. They're written up and signed by people in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. These things have happened very much under the radar of parliaments. I mean, we've signed 80 of these things already. You know, I think there was a case where Australia tried to do something that a company didn't like. I think it might have been an American company. Turned out Australia didn't have a bilateral investment treaty with America. So the company was stymied, right?
Yeah.
They can't use it. No. What they did is they reincorporated part of themselves in Mauritius. And Mauritius does have a bilateral investment treaty with Australia. And so they sued them from Mauritius.
Wow.
A British company could sue Great Britain as long as they move their incorporation site to some little atoll in the Pacific with whom we do have a bilateral investment treaty.
And it didn't matter that what they were worried about actually predated their move to this different nation.
No. And what they were worried about was Australians wanted to label cigarettes as being not terribly good for you.
That's appalling. Yeah. Indeed. You say that politicians may not know, perhaps not much more than we do, and what comes through the, you know, what the ordinary person in the street, as we say, what comes through the media. Is that true? They perhaps not know much more?
Well, some of them certainly, yeah, because we've asked them, we other people who, you know, I deal with, have asked their local MP, and their local MP has sent them, you know, the thing which is being sent out, you know, to say, aha, this is our position, this is what we understand. And like I said, you read it and you think, you know, it's just gibberish. It doesn't make any sense. It clearly shows they don't understand what they're talking about. You know, they say things like, well, we like all of the benefits which these things will bring. Okay, problem number one, there have been four studies I know of, big studies, the first by the World Bank in 2002, which said, you know what, they don't bring those. There's no proven connection between having one of these treaties and getting lots of jobs, and there's no link. That's the World Bank saying that. So that's problem number one. And then they say, so we'd love all of these benefits, the benefits that may not exist, but we just think that maybe we could do without the investor-state dispute settlement bit. Okay, can we please sit down here? If you look at NAFTA, the granddaddy of all of these things, and this is just, you can look it up, it's all publicly available. If you look up the initial text that was written up by the Americans for the free trade agreement, I think it's something like 13 chapters. And remember, the bilateral investment treaty, which contains the investor-state dispute settlement bit, the DOLS, is chapter 11. If you compare the text that was originally created with the one that was finally signed, all of the chapters were heavily changed. There'd be brackets and bits crossed out and little, can we add this? And you look at the final text and yes, there was obviously a lot of discussion and a lot of things were changed. And then you look at chapter 11, the bilateral investment bit. Do you know that not one word of that was changed? In other words, they'll compromise on everything, but that bit, not one word. This notion that we're going to get these trade agreements, but it won't have the investor-state dispute and it won't have bilateral investment, that's just fantasy.
Yeah, that very much gives the impression that that really is the heart of what it's all about. And all the rest of it, you can sort of tinker about with that, but you have to leave that heart absolutely in place, and that's how it's going to function.
Yes, because that's the bit that hands power from sovereign nations to companies. Mm. The company, not the nation in which they exist, the company. An American company doesn't have to go to Congress and say, please, pretty please, could you do something about Great Britain? The company just balls up and said, you know what, matey, Great Britain, we're taking you to arbitration. Yeah. You don't have a choice.
Yeah. And there's hardly anything of this in the media, is there? I mean, everything that comes over from, I just went to the BBC and I just picked up an article at random, and it just goes on about how this is going to be great at, you know, substantially reducing tariffs, eliminating them in some cases, it says. And it's going to open up trade in goods and services, boost investment flows between countries, boost economic growth, etc. There wasn't any mention of what you've just been talking about.
No, and what some of what you just said is patently not true. There is no link between these in bilateral investment treaties, the meaningful bit of these trade agreements, and investment. How do I know that? Well, the 2002 study from the World Bank would be a good place to start. Mm. And then you can look at practical examples. I think Brazil doesn't have any, and yet Brazil has more foreign direct investment than any other country. They have to beat them off with sticks. So if they were so necessary, how come everyone's flocking to the door of a country that doesn't have any of these agreements? Answer me that, Mr. Genius financial person.
No.
And they don't have an answer.
So are you saying essentially this is a bunch of lies?
Well, it's one of those weaving together of small bits of truth with a large amount of lies. But as long as there's a few bits, it's like a counterfeit coin. As long as it's shiny on the outside, who knows that it's tin on the inside? So will it reduce tariffs? Yes, certainly. So there won't be a tariff which says your dodgy meat, we're going to stick a tariff on it. Oh, that'll go. Fantastic. It will say, you know, we can't protect a local manufacturer from a global corporation that wants to dump products below cost on our market, which a large company can do because it can take a loss leader. It can make a loss on that for as long as it takes to put the local company out of business. And then it can hike the prices up because it's got no competitors. Has that happened before? Countless times. Would they lose any sleep over it? You know, wake up and smell the coffee. Of course they won't. That's called business. Nothing personal, mate. Mm. So when they say there would be benefits, the question you need to ask is, for whom? When they say it will be wonderful for the economy, whose economy? Your personal economy or the economy that gets quoted on the stock exchange? Do you own any stocks? If you don't, then it doesn't matter how high the stock market goes, it's not going to benefit you, is it? And we know that the top 5% of most countries own up to 80% of stocks and shares. So when the stock market goes up, you're watching people who are wealthy getting wealthier than you. Well, congratulations, enjoy.
Yeah. So every time you read a word in one of these statements, you have to think, well, what's the real meaning? Every word seems to have a double meaning.
And the thing is that they're not complicated double meanings. I mean, it's just, I think people have become either lazy or anesthetized or just overwhelmed. And they never hear another side to the debate. That's what appalled me about the whole financial crisis is, was there ever a debate about the nature of the crisis? Was it liquidity? Was it solvency? Was there ever a debate about what are the various options? What could we do? Was there a debate about what could be done about levels of sovereign debt? Did you ever hear about the idea of a debt jubilee or of debt cross-cancelling? Did you ever hear of such a thing?
I did, but not through the mainstream.
Exactly. Did you ever hear of the Calvo Doctrine? No one's ever heard of it. It's a piece of international law. And it says that there should not be any such thing as vulture funds. A nation state should always settle disputes with it in its own courts, which would be the opposite of arbitration. That piece of international law predates trade agreements and bilateral investment treaties by probably 3/4 of a century. International lawyers will pretend it doesn't exist. It does. Look it up, the Calvo Doctrine. So we never hear these debates. I'm not saying don't believe them. Just sign up and listen to me and march behind me in lockstep. No, I'm saying look at what the alternatives are and ask yourself, why were we never told there were alternatives? I mean, that was the phrase, wasn't it? The financial crisis. There is no alternative.
Absolutely.
Tina, yeah. That was the first, biggest, and most often repeated lie. There were alternatives. And they've spent 5 years desperately slamming shut all doors that would lead to those other alternatives. And that's the real danger. That there is the danger. Because once you've closed off all reasonable, civilized, democratic means of saying, actually, we'd like to change our minds and go in a different direction, when you said, well, you can't because now you're tied by law, what does that leave people with?
Effectively a dictatorship, absolutely.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you in a moment, actually, about the effects on democracy a little bit more. The couple of things that I missed out that I wanted to ask, one was to do with intellectual property. Mm. What concerns do you have that these agreements might have? And I'm thinking about the concerns that have been expressed by groups like Electronic Frontier Foundation, and they've said that it's going to have detrimental effects on the way the internet works, perhaps a clamping down on free speech in many ways, using copyright law. Do you have concerns like that?
Yes, they are not my top concerns, but they are concerns because I think they would like to do away with people's ability to use things for things like fair comment. I mean, on the internet, it has been a slightly Wild West-ish feel where were you to use other people's material the way we do on the net in a book, no publisher would touch it. But the feeling is on the net, look, I'm not trying to sell you a book. I'm not trying to make a profit from this. Therefore, we should relax the grip of intellectual property. This is just on my website. I've quoted this thing and I'm not trying to make any money. And that's generally how people view it. Are you trying to make money out of it? Yes, then we'll sue you. Is this just, you know, Joe Bloggs wanting to make to quote something or have a picture up to illustrate something? The way you might in a conversation in your house and you say, oh, let me show you this picture. And you open up a book and you show the person a picture, which clearly says under it, copyright Getty Pictures, but you just show them it. People have imagined that the internet works that way. It's like me inviting you into your house and showing you a picture I've got in a book. And they want to say, no, on the internet, this is like publishing. Well, if you go down that route, then the people who own that will have to be paid, which means the average person won't be able to pay them. So that will not happen. And that great flowering of communication will stop.
And do you think it's actually going to go as far as stopping fair use as well? That's fairly well defined, isn't it? If you are actually commenting upon something in detail and you're just using a very small part of a work in order to demonstrate what you're talking about, that's been okay up to now. But do you think they're going to clamp down on that too?
No, I don't think it'll go that far, but I think they'll make it much more difficult. It'll be like the right to strike. They will never say there is no right to strike. But the level of the bar over which you have to jump will be raised and raised and raised. And I think the same thing will happen with copyright.
Mm. It'll be another chilling effect.
Yeah, I do. And the thing is, I don't think that makes me a conspiracy theorist. I think it just says I look at what's been happening and I look at which way the slope is going. Is it going up or down? Slope is continuously up. That's the way it'll continue. I mean, most big business doesn't really like the great unwashed having a strong opinion. I mean, they use the libel laws to stop it.
Yeah, well, presumably this is why they've kept the whole thing so secret with these agreements being negotiated, because they don't want anybody to have an opinion and express an opinion about it.
No. Well, I mean, the TISA agreement, the Trade and Services Agreement, that's the one no one's heard of, and that's by far and away the most dangerous, because as far as I can see, and of course the provisions are largely kept secret, it would basically make all of the things which people said they would do to international finance to make it safer, all the things which government said that we will bring in to change this and make that safer and regulate the other, all of them would have the legs cut out from underneath them by the Trade and Services Agreement. It would just run an end game around all of the stuff that our flatulent politicians have wheezed on about. And it's being conducted very much in secret.
So this is going to be the same kind of financial insecurity in the system that we had prior to 2008, which we saw the fruit of that. That's going to be now written large through these agreements.
Much larger. Yeah, much, much larger. The mistakes that were made are being done again in a different set of acronyms. And it's what you said at the start. There's such a sort of mix of acronyms that you get lost in it. And if you try to explain it, people, you can see them in mental pain. Just
switch off.
Yeah. Well, if you want to keep something secret, you don't keep it secret by hiding it away. You just keep it secret in plain sight by just making it seem technical. You dress it up in jargon. You give it lots of boring acronyms. You never explain it to people in simple terms. And if they try to understand it, you condescend to them and say, well, you don't have a degree in economics, do you? No, I didn't think so. Well, run along, leave it to us. Leave it to the technocrats. Well, do so at your peril.
Yes, so it's interesting you bring up that word technocrat there. So do you think this is essentially a technocratic approach to the world's economy that's being set up here?
Yes, I do. I mean, I actually think what's happened is the financial global class, that group of technocratic people, learned a lesson from the environmental movement of the 70s. And I think they've said, you know what, this is spaceship Earth. And therefore, if you were on a nuclear sub sailing along at high speed in the canyons of the deep ocean, would you have votes on whether to turn left or right, or would you leave it to a captain? And I think they now come to the conclusion that there is a sort of a technocratic financial version of that idea of Spaceship Earth. And they've just said, look, there are lots of things about the workings of this little bubble that we live in, which are way too complicated for the great unwashed to be allowed to have any say in. So what we should do is have the dress-up version of democracy, where we get to dress up in different colored clothes and parade around once every 4 or 5 years, and people can have fun voting for this color or that color. And this color and that color will decide whether the deck chairs should be in this arrangement, in squares or in circles. But everything important should be left to the technocrats, the captain and his crew. That's their vision. And again, does that sound sort of conspiracy theorist? Well, it might do. But if it does, then you need to wake up, because what happened in Italy? Was that man elected? No, he was not elected. Oh. He was simply imposed. Who by? Well, by the Troika, by unelected people that the Italians didn't know, whose names the Italian people didn't know, and who was given powers the Italian people never gave him. And he just said, right, well, this is what's going to happen.
Taste of things to come. And what amazed me and my wife, actually, when we first heard about that, was just how people didn't seem, on the whole, to be outraged by that.
No. Well, I mean, people weren't outraged, because, I mean, if the generals decided that an elected government wasn't doing the job, and they rolled up into the central square with tanks, and on the basis of them pointing tanks at people, they said, right, you're out, go home, we're installing our man in charge, we would recognize that for what it is, a putsch, because it's done with tanks. Mm. But when it's done with dollars, pounds, and fountain pens, we don't recognize it for what it is. When an elected government is removed, yes, and someone who wasn't elected is simply installed by a small group of powerful people on nothing more than their say-so and threats of dire things that will happen if we don't do it, that is a putsch. But because there weren't tanks in the street, we didn't realize it was.
Yes.
But what is a technocratic government other than an unelected government that's simply put in power by people who want those things to happen, and therefore they put someone in charge who will make sure they do happen?
They put in inverted commas, an expert in charge.
Yes. And
their expert.
That's their expert, who just happens to share all of their views of the world. Well, you know, that's what the generals always do. They have a view of how the country should run, and they put one of theirs in charge, and we all recognize it. Because it's bankers, we somehow go, oh, okay, yes, oh, should we have an expert in charge? Well, you know, golly gee willikers, those experts really did a bang-up job in 2007-08, didn't they? Absolutely. I mean, there were people saying from 2002 onwards, at least, people who I know, insiders, traders, people who were well known, who were writing memos saying, this is hugely dangerous, this is going to explode, this is going to be a disaster in the making. They were ignored for half a decade by those experts, and then those experts say, only we can save you.
So when you titled your address in Manchester, Trade Deals and the Death of Democracy, you did mean that quite literally then, that this, we're looking at the death of democracy if these deals go through. I mean, are you absolutely serious about that?
Yes, I am absolutely serious about that. It's not these deals in themselves would wallop democracy, would deal it a really serious, perhaps mortal blow, but it's not just them. I mean, they are part and parcel of a whole series of measures and ways of doing things, which when you put them together are the end of democracy. You know, as I said, the whole idea of vulture funds being able to buy up debt and hold a nation to ransom happens in exactly the same way as these investor-state dispute settlements. There's a whole series of things which, when you add them up, seems to me it hollows out democracy. We have the dress-up version of it. We're essentially saying these things should be decided outside of any democratic control, left to unelected experts. When we say that banks are too big to fail, that also means that they're too big to sue. You cannot, and this is just a fact, the US State Department said it in as many words, sorry, the US Justice Department, you can't take this list of too big to fail institutions to court and take criminal proceedings against them, because a criminal proceeding would destroy the bank. That's precisely why Wachovia and HSBC, although they did launder hundreds of billions, the judgment wasn't a criminal one. And so in the final settlement, it didn't say you are criminally guilty of having laundered money. There is no such statement. And I am not saying they did, because if I did, I'd be sued. I'm saying very clearly they didn't criminally launder. What happened is money was laundered in those banks. Confused? Sound a little hair-splitting? Yeah. And that means those institutions are outside of democratic control. They're above the law. We have to bail them out even when they flagrantly and repeatedly break our laws. And we can't even take them to court for having broken them. That's not me saying it. There was statements like that from the Justice Department. That's just the case. And you can't even write an article which says somebody, a bank, did launder money. I know, because I wrote such an article and it was spiked and I was threatened with losing my house by the bank. So I can't even tell you about it. You know, I know what the facts are, but there are ways of making the truth illegal.
I said before the beginning of the interview that I wanted to ask you a rather obscure question, really, I suppose, but I think it could be quite illuminating, about the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin, who speaks about what he calls inverted totalitarianism. And so much about what we've just been discussing has been pointing towards totalitarianism. And he's describing the US since the middle of the 20th century. And he identifies one of the characteristics of this inverted totalitarianism to be a kind of mirror image of what happened with the National Socialists in Germany, where the state controlled business, it controlled industry. The state and industry very much in bed, but it was the state that was in control. Mm. But he's saying essentially that now we have the case that business is dominating the state, so that government is effectively the servant of corporations. So it's still totalitarian, it's just the other way around. Do you think that model is being imposed upon the whole globe now through these arrangements?
Yes, I do. Yes. I mean, what else is the investor-state dispute settlement than that? It hands a greater power than sovereignty to corporations. A corporation can sue us for loss of earnings, take us to arbitration. We, the nation, the people of this nation, cannot take a corporation to arbitration and sue them for the loss of our earnings. And you might say, well, I mean, what would that even be? The Bank of England's own figures said that the financial crisis caused by a small number of financial institutions have cost this country in direct costs and loss of earnings, by the Bank of England's own estimate, a minimum of 1.4 trillion. Now, if I was a company, I would say you expropriated 1.4 trillion from me and I'd take it to arbitration and I'd win. But we can't do that to them. You look at someone like Henry Paulson, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, who was the man who said, unless you pass the $800 billion TARP, the bailout,
yes,
there will be tanks on the streets that,
that's right. Yeah.
Everyone will lose their house. There'll be anarchy. And so you would think, okay, here's a clear example that this is totalitarianism with the state in charge. But wait a minute. A few years earlier, he'd been the CEO of Goldman Sachs. And when he was the CEO of Goldman Sachs, he had lobbied for parts of those laws which had restrained banks, which had been put in place after the Great Depression. He was the one who was lobbying for them to be gotten rid of. And he was turned down. And then he becomes Secretary of the Treasury. And guess what? Those things were gotten rid of. And then a few years later, the inevitable happens. And then he leaves. He's no longer Secretary of the Treasury and goes back to Wall Street. So is he, in his person, an example of the totalitarianism of the state? Or is he an example of the totalitarianism of the markets, just putting their men in the state? Well, it becomes, is the glass half empty or is it half full? In a way, you don't want to get caught up in those arguments. You just say, let me look at the people. Give me their names. And you know what? You're looking at less than 100 names globally. It doesn't matter what their job description is at any one time. We're talking about a small group of people who have a vision of how the world should be run and work hard for that vision to be put in, enshrined into law. And sometimes they do it from Wall Street and the City Mile, and sometimes they do it from the front benches, the back benches, or Congress.
Yeah, I see what you mean. It becomes pointless to label them after a while. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Some small group have a vision which they are going to thrust upon us and our children. Whether you want to say they're totalitarian state, which is what libertarians always want to tell you, or whether it's what the Marxists want to tell you, which is terrible capitalists, in the end, it's terrible people who have this job, this diamond, that job another time.
But unfortunately, it's terrible, powerful people. And as you say, not many of them, but they are super powerful, aren't they? So, I'm bound to ask you this question, what you think we can actually do about any of this?
There are a couple of answers. We still have the remnants of a democracy, and we need to speak out now. We need to talk to people. And that sounds so soft. But as you said, most people don't know. Most people are unaware. What I always say to people is, you have to fight the peace. You have to be to stand up and be counted and say what you want to say before war is declared. Everyone can be a hero when war has been declared. It's difficult to stand up in a room of people and start saying things which everyone regards as a bit over the top.
Well, you brought up the phrase conspiracy theorist a couple of times, and that's exactly where you will be called that.
Of course, yeah. Mm. I mean, basically, there's got to be a handy phrase, enemy of the state if you were in Soviet Russia, yeah. Or communist agitator if you were in America in the 50s. And what will it be today? What it'll be today is called domestic extremists. That's what I'll be labeled. That's what you will probably be labeled. The description will be those people who hold extreme opinions and they hold them not for any rational reason, but out of some kind of religious fervor. And they will stick to those opinions, even if the mere voicing of those opinions harms other people. So, for instance, talking down the economy. These things will be the traits which become talked about in the next 2 years as being the traits of domestic extremists. You have to fight the peace. You have to fight the time before there are tanks on the street. You have to fight for what's right and point out what's wrong when it seems a little bit over the top, and risk people thinking you're a bit of a numpty. Risk the embarrassment when people snigger at you and point at you. If you're not even willing to take on being laughed at, then how really do you expect to protect your children's future if you find that too much to ask, that someone might snigger at you? But the problem is, if you don't fight the peace, you will at some point have to fight the war. Is it too much to ask that you should risk people sniggering at you if the reward is you avoid the war? But if you keep your head down, at some point, democracy will be rolled back. And then what will you do? And it will end in violence. And I, as a Quaker, am not big on violence.
Absolutely, nor am I, indeed. I suppose a lot of people seem to think that the state of democracy that we have at the moment is something that's, I mean, we know it's not always been there, but, you know, you live within it and you think it's normal. But actually, it isn't normal, is it, when you look back at history?
No, it's not. I mean, people seem to think that because most of us were born into it, I think we've been lulled into this feeling that it's as natural as sunshine.
Yeah.
It's not. And it's so easy for it to be taken away. It requires blood to get, but it can be given away with the stroke of a biro. And it is being given away by people who really don't care, because they don't need democracy to be wealthy and well off. You do. Democracy protects the non-powerful. It's the only thing which protects them.
And how long do you think we've got? I mean, we've only got a bit of democracy as it is, but the little bit that we've got, I mean, how long have we got to hold on to that now?
I think if I could give you a good answer to that, someone would have shot me. I don't know. Wasn't it Pitt the Younger who said, when someone came rushing into his office saying, "My God, the country is ruined." And he said, "Well, actually, there's a lot of ruin left in the country." And yes, that's true. And I think the door is not shut yet. But you just have to look at the number of ways in which our ability to change things democratically is being given away. Each one of those doors that closes leaves us with fewer paths to tread where we can affect change in a civilized and democratic and peaceful means. I don't think we can measure the time we've got in decades. I do not think we can. I mean, that's what I say to my children. My children are 13 and 16. And I say to them, it will be decided in my lifetime, not in yours, in my lifetime. It will all be decided. And therefore, it's on my watch and yours, Julian. It's on your watch and mine. People say, why do you write all this stuff? Why do you do these talks? Why? And I say, it's simple. I want to have an answer to the "what did you do during the war, Daddy?" question. We are at war. There's a war on our democracy. Mm. And what are you doing about it? It's now. It will happen on our watch.
So in a sense, it's a kind of a series of shutting doors before us. And one of these doors is, of course, the signing of these agreements, which I understand that they want them to actually be agreed by the end of this year or as soon as possible.
Yeah.
I went to the occupylondon.org.uk website, and they say that once these are agreed, they are effectively permanent. Do you agree with that?
Yes, they are. In other words, that they say in the text, this is an agreement made by a sovereign nation. And then there's other bits of international law which say there are bits of international law which govern how nations can change their minds. And the international lawyers will say, if you arbitrarily change your mind, you're breaking your own laws. And we might be able to sue you for that. I mean, of course, ultimately, we will have to have a radical party. And by radical, I mean what that word means. Radical meaning to pull up by the roots.
This actually prompts me to ask you about reformist politics, which you said in that address. It's over. There's no point in going that route anymore.
No, I don't think there is. I mean, I do think the era of reformist politics is over. Not in the process of being over, it's over. I mean, this is why it's dawned on people how futile it is to vote. Yes. Because they only have reformist parties to vote for. When the political class and the pundits, let's say, you know, the public are so apathetic, and they blame the public and they point their finger and they say, you know, those grubby people on the street corner, they're apathetic, they're stupid, they don't vote. No, I don't think so. I think the public are actually have realized some time ago, wait a minute, they'll say, what is the point of me voting for you or you when neither of you have the power to deliver on any of the things you say you're going to deliver on? Whether people can articulate it as clearly as that, they know that.
I think you're absolutely right. Is this really about reformist politics or party politics in general? Do you think there's any point in voting for any party?
Of the current parties, no. I mean, look, why is it we are still using the parties which are Victorian? The parties that we have, the main parties, date from the Victorian / Edwardian era. Are you driving a Victorian car? Do you have Edwardian clothes? Do you walk around in shoes from 150 years ago? Why do we still imagine that a political system of political parties that's near on 100 years old is fit for the job of the 21st century? We have parties whose ideology blinkers them to the realities in which they themselves exist. And so you have two parties. You have one party which enforces austerity with a gleeful rub of its hands, and another party which enforces austerity by shedding some crocodile tears and wringing their hands in fake sorrow. Well, you know what? If you could save the world through hand wringing, the English would have saved the world centuries ago.
Well, I mean, the answer to your rhetorical question, I suppose, is that we're indoctrinated to believe it.
Yeah.
So how do we get out of that? How do we have some sort of different approach to this?
We will have to have radical politics. Where will they come from? Well, not from the political parties we have right now. We will have to say to ourselves, it is worth voting for a party now, which is small. I mean, you know, I'm a member of the Green Party. Do I think the Green Party will be that radical party? It could be. Will it be? I think actually the radical party we're talking about will emerge out of the good people in many of the different parties, each of them, people within Labour, people perhaps within the Tories, never mind about the Liberal Democrats, saying, yeah, why am I in this particular division of the political world? We have to have such a party. And people always say it would be a wasted vote, voting for a small party because you won't get elected. But if you vote for a party that has already failed you five times in a row, surely that is the wasted vote because you know that they're going to fail. They're going to do it on purpose.
Yeah, but what you're suggesting here seems to be something that'll have to take a great deal of time for people to become aware, really aware and feel what's going on and then think to themselves, I really must do something about this. And by that time, won't it be too late?
If that's how it worked, then yeah, sure. But that's not how moments of real change. I mean, let's look at something on the scale we're talking about, rather small. Let's look at the civil rights movement in America. Small beer. I mean, the rest of the world had already moved on, but the Americans, you know, half a century behind. Did it require the whole of America to sit down and have a long think and put the beer to one side and mull it over? No, it didn't. It required a very small number of people to say, this is not right. And to organize themselves and galvanize themselves and become visible. And their visibility attracted people like candles attract a moth. And a much larger group who hadn't really sat down and thought it all through, but who heard the potted, you know, the much more distilled arguments and said, yeah, you know, that does, yeah, okay. They hadn't thought it all through and they didn't work it all out. But they could see that this was happening and they joined. And so actually those moments of change happen very, very quickly. It's what a tipping point is. You get to a critical point and suddenly a massive change happens very quickly. So I think what it requires is a very much smaller number of people to think these things through and make contact with each other. I mean, this is what I find on the blog. They join the community of people on my blog, and my blog is like one of many. And they join and they say, I've got no one to talk to. No one here believes what I believe. But they find a community and suddenly they're empowered. They think, crikey, I'm not the only person. that's how radical change happens. It happens fast when it gets to that critical point.
You mentioned in the Q&A of that address something called depositor unions.
Yes.
To sort of create a kind of a more direct way of affecting change. Obviously, this applies to the banks, but could it be applied, that kind of principle be applied to corporations in general?
Yes. I mean, all I was doing is saying, before unions came along, if you didn't like the conditions under which you work, what could you do about it? You on your own. And then people said, why don't we club together? And hey, presto, a kind of power was born, which people didn't have before. And all I said is, well, that's great when you're in work. Well, how does that work with, say, money and financial systems? I simply pointed out, look, there are maybe, I'm plucking numbers out of the air, but let's say HSBC has 100,000 depositors in this country. It's many more than that, obviously. Well, if you made contact with each other, you formed just an online club, a union of the depositors, then you could say, you know, we've heard that you're laundering drug money, for instance. We, the depositors union, don't like this. And if you carry on doing this, we, the depositors union, will move our deposits from your bank to some other bank. Now, that's perfectly legal. It's not actually very hard to do. And in fact, there are laws coming in forcing the banks to make it easier for you. That would give you a fantastic amount of power, because no bank can afford for any significant proportion, and with only a significant proportion, like 7% of their depositor base, to just up sticks and move in a week.
Because this is because of the fractional reserve lending.
Yeah, it's called a run on the bank.
Yeah.
So even the threat of that would stop them in their tracks, because there is no law and there is no other power on earth that could save them from a run on the bank by the depositors leaving. So I simply said, imagine that you created the depositors union. And I've actually talked to the unions and said, look, there you are using a Victorian kind of power, the power of workers in the 21st century. By all means, carry on. But you already have 2 million members. Why don't you contact them and say, why don't we, in addition to your union membership, create a depositors union, those of you who are with NatWest, those of you who are with Barclays, and you now are on a, let's say, an online list of those people. You are a group of their depositors. You would then have more power over that bank than the Bank of England, than the financial regulator, or their bondholders. You would have total power over that bank. If you wrote to them as the depositors union, say, you stop this or we move, they would have no choice. So there are forms of power which we can have for ourselves if we just stop being so lazy and just only employing the forms of power which our great-grandparents came up with. I mean, they came up with these things, and we're so lazy, we're still using them.
Can you envisage any way in which that kind of power could be used more generally with corporations? Because we're not just talking about banks, are we?
Well, I mean, more generally, you're talking about a shareholders union.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is most shares are not held by ordinary people.
Mm.
I mean, and even when they're held, in inverted commas, in your pension, the people in charge of that pension are the very same people who are the global overclass we're talking about. So that they're hardly going to do it on your behalf, are they?
No. So what are we talking about? Direct purchasing power then, really?
I think you start with the banks. I mean, the banks are fantastically powerful. If we did, never mind trying to convince our politicians to bring them under control, if we simply did it ourselves, and it doesn't require anything more than making contact with the other depositors in the bank, you would control those banks. And if you control those banks, you control the rest of the financial operation. It's actually there for the taking. And if I can come up with that, and I've talked to a couple of other people, and there are refinements on that which would work even better, then there are other kinds of powers. It's just we haven't bothered to even think about them. Our great-grandparents did, and we just stopped and just said, well, I don't need to think about these things anymore because, you know, I've just got TV dinners and cheese that comes in a squirty bottle, and so I'm fine.
Absolutely, yes, indeed. We need to remind ourselves that we don't live in the world that we think we live in, and realize there's a great deal of responsibility upon our shoulders, and that we can actually change things if we have a mind to, and as you say, work together. I wanted to ask you finally if there is anything, any final thought that you want to leave us with. You've said that we do have some power, if we can grasp it, grasp this moment that we have. Is there any one thing that you would leave us with as the main thought, that if only we could grasp that, it would make a huge amount of difference to us?
I would, but it's not a single practical thing. If there was one single practical thing that you could grasp hold of and do, then we wouldn't be in the kind of pickle we're in. What I would say is this: you go back and you look at the English Revolution, in the 1600s, which we're not even taught about in school. We're talked about the Civil War, and it was the first fashion war, according to what we're taught in school. It was a war between people who wore frilly shirts and others who had bad haircuts.
Right, yeah. Okay.
And it wasn't. It was a revolution. All of the great ideas, the ideas which have made Europe great, of the ideas about which we are so proud and we like to tell the rest of the world about, freedom of the press, freedom of expression, freedom of religious belief, freedom of the press, universal suffrage, all those ideas came out of Englishmen in those decades around a couple of decades before the English Revolution in the early 1600s. They were, in fact, all printed within 300-400 yards of St. Paul's, because we still have those pamphlets. They were saved by a visionary man, and they form the center of the collection at the British Museum. And what I would say to people is, if you look at who wrote them, they were ordinary people. Wynne Stanley, the man who started the diggers, he was a failed businessman from Bolton. He was nobody. And yet he and others like him had the ideas which made Europe what it is. They created the ideas about which we're so proud, and which have given our children and us everything about which we are so proud. And those people were nobody. They were no better than you and me. And we've got to remember, if they can do it, why do we not think we can do it? We're all waiting around saying, well, we must have leadership. There must be a leader who's going to rise. As if there was some town, mysterious town, somewhere hidden in the British Isles, which was breeding leaders. And that when they step off the number 19 bus, there'll be the bright white of leadership shining out of them. We'll all know, my God, the leader has arrived. Follow them. There is no such place. There's you and there's me. And the thing is, we are no worse than the people who started the English Revolution and had those brilliant ideas and dislodged the entire medieval power structure. They did it, and they're no better than us. And it simply requires doing what they did, which was to put their first foot on that path of questioning the things which their betters told them couldn't be questioned. And they did it. And we have unfinished business. And we can do it. People just simply have to speak up. They have to go to a crowded pub. They have to invite people to their house, and they have to speak up. And if they put their foot upon that path, it will lead them to one day giving a talk in Manchester or being interviewed, and they will be telling other people to do the same. And if a small number of people do that, then I truly believe the rest of the people of this country will rise like lions.
And I guess one of the first steps that could be made is to visit websites like yours. You have a blog, in which, in fact, you have a very poignant article, The Disloyal, which I recommend everybody should read. Could you indicate how people can get to your website?
Sure. It goes under the name of Golem, G-O-L-E-M. And then the Roman numerals for 14, so XIV. That's the name I put the blog under. And if you put that into a search engine, Golem XIV, two things come up: the short story, which I took the name from, and my website. And it's a community of people which has grown, and they're ordinary people, but they have decided they're going to set their feet upon that path.
Well, thank you ever so much for speaking with us. It's obviously very, very concerning, and it's depressing in many ways, of course. But I think that you've also given us reason to hope.
I hope so.
In what you've said in the last few minutes, a very definite sense that there are things that we really can do if we raise awareness about this. And so I'm very grateful to you for coming on the program. Thanks very much, David, for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.